The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 29th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. We start with the main stories and how they were covered. Obama's fix for canceled policies. What happened? Health insurers were scrambling this week to determine if they would reissue canceled health care plans after President Obama reversed course and authorized insurers to renew low-cost policies that failed to meet the standards of his health care law. Facing mounting pressure from the public and his own party over the Affordable Care Act's botched rollout, Obama said insurers would no longer be required to scrap plans on the individual market that fell short of the law's coverage requirements, and that those policies could be renewed for 1 year. This fix won't solve every problem for every person, but it's going to help a lot of people, said Obama. So far, only 13 states have said they will allow consumers to renew canceled plans, while 8, including New York, Washington, and Massachusetts, rejected the president's non-binding proposal. Obama's attempt to tamp down the anger over canceled plans failed to satisfy many swing state Democrats facing tough re-election fights in 2014. 39 members of the president's party broke ranks and helped pass a House Republican bill that would allow insurers to sell bare-bones plans canceled under Obamacare to anyone, including new customers. The White House said that legislation would deter younger, healthier people from signing up for more comprehensive coverage through the exchanges, and that Obama would veto the bill if it got to him. What the editorial said. With this modest fix, Obama is trying to stanch the bleeding from a self-inflicted political wound, said the New York Times. It's probably too late to restore most canceled policies. So the real goal here is to remove a source of Republican attacks on the president and Democrats running for re-election. Republicans are playing their own political game by proposing to let anyone buy cheap, substandard plans. Their obvious goal is to destroy, not repair, Obamacare by keeping young, healthy people out of risk pools designed to keep premiums low. The president's lawless executive decree is an illusion, said NationalReview.com. Most insurers will find it too complicated and expensive to reverse policy changes they've spent a year putting into place. That's exactly the reaction the White House was hoping for, enabling it to now blame someone else, the insurers, state regulators, for the consequences of its own law. What the columnist said. Insurers brought this mess on themselves, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. Many carriers used Obamacare as an excuse to issue expensive policies to customers on the individual market without making it clear that they can now shop for cheaper alternatives on the exchanges. The president has now called their bluff. If they don't reissue the old policies, then Obamacare was never responsible for the cancellations in the first place. And if they cave and reinstate the plans, it's a win-win for Obama. Over the next few months, attention will shift away from canceled plans, said Paul Begala in CNN.com. Only a small minority of Americans will pay more for insurance, while millions will get affordable insurance for the first time. Meanwhile, nearly all of us benefit from such ACA provisions as its ban on insurers refusing policies to those with pre-existing conditions. and its ban on cutting off coverage to those who run up big bills fighting cancer or other serious illnesses. Actually, the real political pain may only be starting, said Alex Altman in Time.com. People will soon discover that Obama also wasn't truthful when he said, if you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor. In order to be competitive on Obamacare's exchanges, insurers had to lower their premiums. As a result, many cut costs by narrowing their networks, shrinking the range of doctors that are available to patients. In the political struggle over Obamacare's fate, perception will determine reality, said Megan McArdle in Bloomberg.com. If insurers and Democrats in Congress stick with Obama through the troubled rollout period over the next 6 months, there's a good chance the White House can get Obamacare working and win over the public. But if new problems continue to surface, both Democrats and insurers are going to stampede for the exit. Then the law and this presidency may collapse. Our second main story, remembering JFK. The nation this week commemorated the 50th anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's assassination, as President Barack Obama and Bill Clinton laid a wreath near the eternal flame that marks Kennedy's grave in Arlington National Cemetery. Flags flew at half-mast in cities across the country, while thousands gathered in Dallas to attend a memorial event in DeLay Plaza, the city park where Kennedy was killed by a sniper's bullet on November 22, 1963. A Gallup poll showed that Americans still rate Kennedy as the best president since World War II, with 74% saying he was an outstanding or above-average leader. Kennedy's legacy has weathered half a century of assault, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. Historians rank him as an overrated president who couldn't pass key legislative initiatives, escalated the conflict in Vietnam, and recklessly engaged in relentless womanizing. But that's not how Americans see it. They remember him still as the youthful charmer who turned the White House into an idealistic Camelot and fluently spoke the stirring language of destiny and determination. Kennedy's legacy rests primarily on posthumous myth-making, said William Prochnow in Reuters.com. After his death, Kennedy's many admirers made Camelot the romantic theme of his presidency. Various conspiracy theories endure, and the story has become a Shakespearean tragedy. A young nobleman cut down at his empire's prime by powerful and shady characters who prevent the truth about his death from ever coming out. Americans still revere Kennedy for a deeper reason, said Alan Brinkley in the Atlantic.com. He remains a powerful symbol of a lost moment. The early 1960s was a time of great optimism, when the horrors of the World War had faded. America was strong and confident, and belief in our grand national project had not yet been jaded by Vietnam, racial conflict, other assassinations, and Watergate. Kennedy embodies an era, never to be seen again, when the nation's capacities looked limitless. Well, this week was a good week for narcissism. After the Oxford University Press declared that selfie, taking a self-portrait with a smartphone, was the new word of the year for 2013. It was a good week for taking your car, after an Amtrak train supposedly bound for New York City left Philadelphia, took a wrong turn onto the wrong track, and wound up in Philly's suburbs. It was a good week for admitting you were wrong, eventually. After the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Patriot News apologized for an 1863 editorial that dismissed President Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as, quote, silly remarks, end quote. The paper said its previous editors must have been under the influence of partisanship or of strong drink. It was a bad week for the need to know after British researchers admitted that they had killed the world's oldest living animal, a 507-year-old Icelandic clam, when they opened its shell to determine its age. It was a bad week for reenactments after police in upstate New York confiscated a replica Civil War cannon from a man who'd allegedly fired it for 8 consecutive days at his neighbors' homes over a neighborhood dispute. I don't recall during my 34-year career taking a cannon, said Sheriff Joseph Gerice. It was a bad week for field trips after school outings to Toronto City Hall were suspended amid concerns that Mayor Rob Ford had made the building unsafe for kids. The erratic behavior, the vulgar language, it's just not deemed an appropriate environment to bring children into, said Counselor Karen Stentz. On the briefing page this week, New York's liberal mayor, Bill de Blasio, the new mayor of New York City, was a leftist firebrand in his youth. Has he changed? How did de Blasio win the election? He entered the race with little name recognition, having served without much fanfare as a city councilman and public advocate. But de Blasio emerged from a crowded Democratic primary field on a broadly progressive platform, saying that under incumbent Michael Bloomberg, New York had become a tale of two cities, one inhabited by a wealthy elite in skyscrapers, and another by millions of poor and working-class people struggling to get by. De Blasio proposed raising taxes on the rich to pay for pre-kindergarten programs and increase access to affordable housing, and put his biracial family at the core of his campaign. That populist message won de Blasio a landslide victory with 73% of the vote. But New York's first Democratic mayor in 20 years comes into office with some constituents worried about whether he'll put the city, now one of the nation's safest and most prosperous, back on a course that led to the crime, squalor, and fiscal chaos of the 1970s. I have no trouble praising de Blasio's political skills, said Fred Siegel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. It's his governing that worries me. Where does he come from? De Blasio was born in Manhattan as Warren Wilhelm, Jr. His parents were former magazine editor Maria de Blasio and Warren Wilhelm, a U.S. Army veteran who won a Purple Heart after losing a leg fighting the Japanese in the Pacific. Wilhelm went on to work in the Commerce Department in the 1950s, but was fired after he and his wife were targeted by Senator Joseph McCarthy's anti-communist witch hunts. He later drifted into alcoholism, and his wife divorced him, taking her two youngest sons to live with her. By the time Wilhelm Jr. graduated from high school, he had taken the first name Bill, a nickname derived from Wilhelm, and his Italian-American mother's maiden name. When de Blasio was 18, his father committed suicide by shooting himself in the heart. De Blasio later said his father's decline from war hero to intemperate drunk affected him deeply. I learned what not to do, he said. Where did he get his views? De Blasio was a student organizer in high school, and his zeal for politics and love of Italian sandwiches led classmates to nickname him Senator Provolone. He was a student activist at New York University, protesting tuition hikes and nuclear power, and in 1988 went to Nicaragua to aid the leftist Sandinista revolution. There he joined other liberal Americans in handing out food and medical supplies in defiance of the Reagan administration, which put an embargo on the country's Marxist government. De Blasio worked at a health clinic where he saw how state-funded doctors gave personal care to every family in town. "There was something I took away from that," he said, "how hands-on government has to be, how proactive, how connected to the people it must be." After that experience, De Blasio described himself as a democratic socialist. What was his first job in politics? De Blasio became an aide to Democratic Mayor David Dinkins in 1989 after volunteering for his campaign. He went on to become a well-respected political operative, ascending to the role of campaign manager for Hillary Clinton's 2000 Senate race. But the candidate's inner circle became frustrated by De Blasio's perceived inability to make decisions without eliciting every available opinion. And he was unofficially sidelined in favor of Clinton's veteran aide, Patty Solis Doyle. After Clinton won, staffers printed up T-shirts poking fun at their campaign manager's ruminative style, featuring an off-sided De Blasio qualifying statement: "In a perfect world, ... What did he do next? De Blasio ran for office himself and was elected to the city council in 2001. As a councilman, De Blasio pushed for reforms to child welfare and a crackdown on bad landlords. But he also championed job-creating businesses and real estate developments in his Brooklyn district. State Senator Tony Avella, who served on a council with De Blasio, said he was more of a pragmatist than an idealist and moved to the left only when running for mayor. "I don't think he's always been this progressive," Avella said. How will Mayor De Blasio govern? Those who know him well predict he will make helping poor and working-class citizens a priority, but he will also be willing to cut deals and seek compromise. The first big tone setter will be De Blasio's decision on stop and frisk, the New York Police Department's controversial policy of searching anyone on the street whom officers deem suspicious. De Blasio must decide if he'll seek reforms or scrap the entire policy, which supporters say has dramatically cut the crime rate, but which the mayor-elect and other critics say often produces a demeaning form of racial profiling. It will be the first test of how De Blasio balances his progressive promises with the reality of governing. The mayor-elect himself, however, says there shouldn't be any confusion. "My grounding is progressive movements, in progressive movements is pretty solid, and it continues to be a way I think about the world," he said. Turn now to the best columns from the U.S. The first from David Frum at thedailybeast.com. Obamacare can't be repealed. Repealing Obamacare is no longer an option, no matter who becomes president in 2016, said David Frum. Though the program's malfunctioning website has slowed signups through the insurance exchanges, more than 2 million people have already enrolled in Obamacare's expanded Medicaid program in Arizona, California, Illinois, and other states. Despite the Affordable Care Act's many problems, millions more will eventually succeed in purchasing insurance through the exchanges. Its beneficiaries are rapidly coalescing into a vested interest. By 2016, a repeal ACA Republican president would have to strip up to 10 million people of a government benefit they had enjoyed for the last 3 years. It would be the most radical reduction in social coverage ever seen in a democratic country. Even Ronald Reagan wouldn't have dared. I'm no fan of either Medicaid or Obamacare, but Republicans who dangle promises of full repeal are in denial. Obamacare is a fact, and conservatives need to create an alternative that its many beneficiaries, including hospitals, insurers, and drug companies, will accept. Repeal is a fantasy. Reform is the task ahead. This from Fred Hyatt at the Washington Post. How China muzzles Americans. China's government is now censoring Americans, said Fred Hyatt. While it's well known that Beijing diligently controls what its own citizens read, hear, and watch, few in the U.S. realize how often the Communist Party exerts its control over journalism and academic scholarship here. Last year, Bloomberg's website was blocked in China after it published groundbreaking investigations on the Communist Party's corrupt elites. Another major investigation by the news organization is now on hold because editors fear the company's journalist and business interest will be permanently booted from China. Academic scholars who specialize in China have been denied visas to enter the country for daring to write about ethnic minorities in conflict with the government or other forbidden topics. These bans exert powerful influence, since for a China scholar, the inability to do field research could be terminal. Earlier this year, New York University forced a Chinese dissident to leave its law school rather than endanger its new campus in Shanghai. As American organizations buckle under the pressure, Chinese officials are learning that their hardball tactics can succeed. And finally, from Mark Joseph Stern at Slate.com, the Cheneys revealing family feud. An ugly feud has erupted between Dick Cheney's daughters, said Mark Joseph Stern, and Republicans richly deserve this sleazy, rotten mess. Liz Cheney, her dad's political protege, decided this year to mount a Republican primary challenge to three-term U.S. Senator Mike Enzi. To counter Enzi's very conservative record, the ambitious Liz had to move even further to the right, an effort complicated by her very public lesbian sister, Mary, who has two children with her partner, Heather Poe. In conservative Wyoming, married lesbians frighten voters. So Liz cynically announced for the first time that she's opposed to gay marriage. Clearly shocked and hurt, Mary shot back with a message that Liz is on the wrong side of history. While Poe noted that Liz had often been a guest in their home and used to say how happy she was for them. In the end, Liz's desperate anti-gay pandering will achieve nothing. She's trailing Enzi by 52 points in the polls. After she suffers an ignominious rout, Liz might be tempted to spout the usual cliche that she's looking forward to spending more time with her family. But what happens when you've thrown your family under the bus? In the last word section this week, we have an article titled My Friend, Lee Harvey Oswald. The frustrated loser I knew, said Paul Gregory, was desperate to prove he was truly exceptional. It was 7 a.m. on Sunday when the phone echoed through my parents' red brick house in Fort Worth. Mr. Gregory, a woman said as my father picked up, I need your help. The caller said that she had been a student in his Russian language course at our local library and that he knew her son. My father, Pete Gregory, linked the voice to a nurse who sat in the back of his class and had once identified herself as Oswald. Until this phone call, he hadn't realized that she was the mother of Lee Harvey Oswald, a Marine who had defected to the Soviet Union, only to return 2.5 years later with a Russian wife and a 4-month-old daughter. My father had helped Lee and his young family get settled in Fort Worth a year earlier. The Oswalds had been my friends. It was also clear why Marguerite Oswald needed his help. 2 days earlier, Marguerite's son had shot John F. Kennedy. While Lee Harvey Oswald was sitting in a Dallas jail cell, his wife and mother and 2 young daughters were hiding out. Marina Oswald had become the most wanted witness in America. She needed a translator fast. The Secret Service first knocked on my parents' door at 3 a.m. on the morning of November 23, 1963. The following day, an agent named Mike Howard picked my father up and drove him to meet Robert Oswald, Lee's brother. As the family's translator of choice, he was now part of the plan to get the Oswald women out of their dingy hotel room and into a safe house that Robert had arranged at his in-law's farm so Marina could be questioned. The scene at the hotel was worse than my father had expected. Marina, already thin, appeared extremely gaunt. She was having difficulty breastfeeding Rachel, her young daughter, who was not yet 5 weeks old. As the men began packing the car, Howard whispered that Lee Harvey Oswald had just been shot. With Oswald dead, Marina's testimony became even more important. Marina chain-smoked and drank coffee and was asked question about Lee's rifle, a photo of him holding the assassination weapon, and his various associates. My father, who was then 59, translated furiously. Through my father, I had become a close, or, as Robert Oswald would later say, almost the only friend of Lee and Marina Oswald's from virtually the moment they arrived in Fort Worth in June 1962 until the end of that November. While that 5-month period might seem fleeting, it was a significant period in Oswald's life. He was never in the same place for long. By age 17, he had already moved some 20 times. Then he dropped out of high school and joined the Marines, before being released and traveling to Moscow. He avoided deportation by attempting suicide and was sent to Minsk, where he met Marina. In the year and a half after he returned to the United States, he moved several more times. My friendship with him was perhaps the longest he'd ever had. From nearly the moment I met Lee Harvey Oswald, it seemed that he felt the world had sized him up wrong. He wasn't much of a student, and the Marines overlooked his talents. By now his luck was changing, but now his luck was changing. As virtually the only American living in Minsk, he became something of a celebrity in that provincial capital. Oswald assumed his experience as an American living in the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War would be tremendously valuable, and he was already drafting a memoir. He kept a journal, which he labeled Historic Diary. When he, Marina, and little June touched down at Love Field on June 14, 1962, he greeted his brother Robert by asking where the reporters were. A week and a half after his return, he went to the Continental Life Building in downtown Fort Worth. Earlier that morning, my father, a successful petroleum engineer, had received a call from a young man who wanted certification in fluency in Russian. Rather than tell him there wasn't much of a market for a Russian translator in 1960s Texas, my father, who fled Siberia during the Civil War, welcomed the chance to meet this fellow Russian speaker in person. He told him to come in for a meeting. around 11 a.m., with the temperature climbing into the 90s, a slight 22-year-old Oswald arrived, drenched with sweat and wearing a wool suit. My father asked Oswald to translate passages from a Russian book he chose at random, and he was surprised at how well the young man performed. He asked his secretary to type out a "To Whom It May Concern" letter, stating that one Lee Harvey Oswald was qualified to work as a translator. But he also told him that he knew of no jobs in the area that required knowledge of Russian. Upon parting, Oswald offered the address and telephone number of his brother Robert, with whom he and his wife were staying, just in case anything came up. A few days later, my father decided to check up on Oswald and his wife, and because I was around their age and home for the summer, he took me along. When we pulled up to the house, we were greeted warmly by Robert Oswald, a tall and well-spoken man. Lee, by contrast, was restrained. He was short and wiry, his hairline noticeably receding, and he spoke with a southern accent, not Texan, perhaps a relic of time spent in New Orleans during his youth. Lee and Robert invited us to meet Marina, who was slender, almost fragile, with a natural beauty. Lee explained to his wife in Russian that he had invited over a pair of fellow Russian speakers as a favor. And so my father, Pete, led the discussion by asking her questions about their voyage to the U.S., life in Minsk, and what it was like to be a young person in the Soviet Union. Marina answered most of the questions, speaking quietly and occasionally showing photographs. About a week later, my father and I drove from our house to Lee and Marina Oswald's new home, a cramped one-bedroom duplex. My father was taken by Marina, and he wanted to help her. He asked Marina if she would offer me Russian lessons. Before we even set a fee, Marina agreed to see me twice a week. She seemed happy for the company. The next Tuesday, at around 6 p.m., Marina invited me in for my first lesson. The Oswald living room was extraordinarily bare. There was a shabby sofa and a chair and a worn coffee table. As our first session came to an end, we decided that future lessons would take the form of my driving the Oswalds around town and having Marina correct my practical Russian as I pointed out landmarks. This, we reasoned, would be better for my language skills and help Marina learn the city. But we all knew it would also greatly benefit their ability to run errands. On a typical lesson evening, I would show up around 6:30, when Lee got home from his welder's job. We would drive by department stores or Montgomery Ward, and I'd bring them back home by 10. These were lean times for the Oswalds, but they weren't without hope. During a trip to the Fort Worth Botanic Garden, Oswald exuded an air of optimism. He was back in America with a beautiful wife and an adorable daughter. His life ahead promised more study and a possible university degree. A publisher would surely understand the value of his memoir, and he could use it as a platform to further the socialist causes in which he believed. Marina would understand what kind of man he really was. But over the course of these months, it became harder for him to convince her of his exceptionalism. Early that summer, Lee brought home a catalog and class schedule from Texas Christian University, and we eventually decided to drive to the TCU campus so Lee could talk to a school official. But when we arrived, he motioned for Marina and me to wait at a distance while he had a whispered consultation with a woman at a desk. They spoke for a while, but when Lee rejoined us, he was sullen and quiet. At that time, I didn't realize he hadn't graduated from high school. On the Saturday morning after Kennedy was killed, A Secret Service agent at the local chief of police and the local chief of police took me to Oklahoma City for questioning. The agents homed in on the question of the day, which, of course, has lingered over the past 50 years. Did I think Oswald worked alone or as part of a larger conspiracy? I told them simply that if I were organizing a conspiracy, he would have been the last person I would recruit. He was too difficult and unreliable. Over the years, despite public opinion polls, many others have agreed. The opening of formerly secret archives in Russia indicates that the KGB didn't want to recruit Oswald. Cuban intelligence officers, a KGB agent or two, mafia bosses, and even CIA officers, including supposedly members of Nixon's plumbers team, have somehow been tied to Oswald's actions that day. But it's difficult to understand how these conspiracy theories would have worked. Oswald, after all, fled the Texas School Book Depository by Dallas's notably unreliable public transportation system. It's discomforting to think that history could have been altered by such a small player. But over the years, I've realized that was part of Oswald's goal. I entered his life at just the moment that he was trying to prove, particularly to his skeptical wife, that he was truly exceptional. But during those months, his assertion was rapidly losing credibility. Marina would later tell the Warren Commission, through a translator, about his imagination, his fantasy, which was quite unfounded, as to the fact that he was an outstanding man. Perhaps he chose what seemed like the only remaining shortcut to going down in history. On April 10, 1963, Oswald used a rifle with a telescopic sight to fire a bullet into the Dallas home of Major General Edwin Walker, the conservative war hero, narrowly missing his head. Oswald told his wife about the assassination attempt, but she never told authorities before Kennedy's death. 7 months later, a far greater target would be scheduled to pass by the very building where he worked. The whole series of frustrations had now brought him to this final stage, Robert Oswald writes in his memoir. The discouragements and disappointments beginning in his childhood, continuing through the school years, and the years in the Marines, the death of his dream of a new life in Russia, the boring jobs back in the United States, which made it impossible to support Marina adequately and gain some recognition as a man, the whole pattern of failure throughout most of his 23 years led to the outburst of violence in April and the final tragedy in November 1963. This was adapted from a piece that originally appeared in the New York Times. I'd like to read you one of the obituaries this week. The plain-spoken novelist who rejected the feminist label. Doris Lessing, 1919 to 2013. When Doris Lessing learned she had won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2007 from a gaggle of reporters who congregated at her London home, the author gave a characteristically blunt response. "Oh, Christ," she said, "I couldn't care less." She went on, "I'm 88 years old, and they can't give the Nobel to someone who's dead. So I think they were probably thinking they'd better give it to me now before I've popped off." Doris May Taylor was born in Persia, now Iran, and raised on a farm in the wilds of southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, said the Financial Times. Her British parents were a tragic couple. Her father was a troubled World War I amputee, and her mother found rural life in the African bush emotionally difficult. Lessing worked on the farm as a child, but soon escaped to the capital, Salisbury, where she married at the age of 19. Eventually drawn toward communism, she left her husband and their two young children for a leftist German refugee, Gottfried Lessing. "I couldn't stand that domestic life," she later said. "It's this business of giving all the time, day and night, trying to conform to something you hate." Before long, she also became disillusioned with Lessing, said NPR.org. She took Peter, the son from that marriage, to London in 1949 with nothing to her name but a 20-pound note and the manuscript for her first novel, The Grass is Singing. The novel was a modest success, but it was The Golden Notebook that made her name in 1962. The book chronicles a single mother's political, social, sexual, and emotional awakening in post-war London and was widely hailed as breaking the conventions of traditional novel. It was soon considered a feminist classic, even though Lessing rejected the characterization. "Oh, it's just stupid. I've seen it so often," she said. "There's nothing feminist about The Golden Notebook." The book, she insisted, was mainly about the collapse of communism. Lessing's work drifted from realism into science fiction in the 1960s and 1970s, said the Daily Telegraph. The Four-Gated City imagines a global plague sparking World War III. The Memoirs of a Survivor features a heroine who can travel through space and time. Lessing dabbled in new beliefs, from the psychoanalytic doctrine of R.D. Lang to Islamic Sufism. She became increasingly cynical about the publishing industry, writing two poorly reviewed novels under a pseudonym to deliberately expose the literary world's failure to recognize good writing. Both were rejected by her own publisher, a fact that gave her a great deal of pleasure. In later life, Lessing reveled in her status as a contrarian, said the Los Angeles Times. She visited Pakistan in 1986 to back the cause of the Afghan Mujahideen, but was vocally critical of their treatment of women. Time and again, she broke with the feminist movement, criticizing its emphasis on white middle-class women and sensitivity to what she saw as non-issues like sexual harassment. She was heavily criticized for downplaying the September 11, 2001 attacks as not that terrible compared with the Irish Republican Army's multi-year terror campaign in Ireland and the UK. "I tend to speak my mind, which is not necessarily a good idea," she once said. "I do not think I am the soul of tact." On the health and science page, new guidelines for cholesterol drugs. The nation's leading heart specialists have dramatically shifted their thinking on when doctors should prescribe cholesterol-lowering drugs. New guidelines from the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology abandon the use of a person's cholesterol level as the main trigger for prescribing statins and instead focus on broader risk factors, an approach that could double the number of American candidates for the drugs to roughly 70 million. The new guidelines will treat better and smarter, focusing on populations most likely to benefit, University of North Carolina cardiologist Sidney Smith tells NPR.org. Following a 4-year review of evidence, the research team concluded that statins would be most effective if used by people with high risk factors for heart attacks and strokes, not to bring down levels of a harmful cholesterol, known as LDL, to a specific target. Patients derive comfort from knowing they've hit that LDL target, doctors said, but the number is largely arbitrary. The real value of statins is that they help reduce the buildup of waxy cholesterol in the arteries. Statins treat risk, not only cholesterol, said Neil Stone, a Northwestern University cardiologist who helped craft the new guidelines. Now, statins will be used to reduce the risk of stroke as well as heart disease. Some doctors, however, are already questioning the new guidelines, saying they overstate risk and will lead to unnecessary statin use. The health scare of the week. Testosterone's downside. Receiving testosterone treatments makes older men more likely to have a heart attack or stroke, a new study warns. Researchers at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs reached that conclusion after collecting information on about 8,700 men in their early 60s on the average, with low levels of the male sex hormone. After all of them underwent tests to assess their initial heart health, 1 in 7 started using testosterone gels, patches, or injections. In the 3 following years, 26% of those supplementing their testosterone had a stroke or heart attack or died, compared with 20% of non-users. While testosterone supplements are recommended for men who produced too little on their own, about 5 million men in the U.S., their use has exploded thanks to marketing campaigns that tout their benefits in warding off aging, low sex drive, and fatigue. Taking testosterone is an individual decision, researcher Michael Ho told the Washington Post, but I think it's worth weighing the potential benefits of testosterone therapy versus any potential risks before starting it. On the Talking Points page, Elizabeth Warren, Hillary's nightmare? History might be about to repeat itself for Hillary Clinton, said Noam Scheiber in NewRepublic.com. Clinton was denied the Democratic nomination for president in 2008 by a populist insurgent from the left. 5 years ago, that was Barack Obama. In 2016, it could be Elizabeth Warren. The freshman Massachusetts senator has become a liberal icon due to her tenacious pursuit of banking reforms and blunt criticism of Wall Street executives. She's a prodigious grassroots fundraiser, having raised $42 million in her Senate race last year, and videos of her speaking out for the middle class have racked up millions of YouTube views. Polls show Democrats moving away from Clinton-era Wall Street-friendly centrism and slowly becoming Elizabeth Warren's party. Income inequality is now among the party's biggest concerns. If Warren decides to run, she could accurately portray Clinton as an establishment crony with deep ties to Wall Street, and Hillary's nightmare might come true. Clinton shouldn't lose too much sleep, said Michael Hirsch in NationalJournal.com. Warren may be popular, but she is basically a one-issue political figure, and that issue, financial reform, does not win elections. Americans may be angry with Wall Street, but they don't care about reforming banking practices. Here's why. It's boring and incredibly esoteric. Building a political platform on a better Dodd-Frank Act or a drive to regulate derivatives is a non-starter. Warren's other domestic and foreign policy credentials are, to put it gently, modest, said Hendrik Hertzberg in NewYorker.com. Clinton, meanwhile, has been both a successful senator and a competent Secretary of State, with direct experience handling both foreign and domestic crises. She is as presidential as they come. Hillary is hardly inevitable, said George Will in the Washington Post. American voters see politics today as popular entertainment and are looking for bold characters who will shake up the status quo. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is one, and Warren is arguably another. Clinton, however, is not. This doyen of the Democratic establishment will turn 69 in 2016, with nearly 25 years in politics. She will have become the one thing no successful candidate can be: boring. Democrats who think Clinton is guaranteed the nomination should ask themselves this: when was the last time presidential politics was as predictable as they think it has become? Climate change. Why poor nations suffer most. Should rich countries pay reparations for global warming? Said Annie Lowry in NYTimes.com. Representatives of about 130 developing nations raised the provocative question during last week's climate talks in Warsaw, held days after Typhoon Haiyan slammed into the Philippines, killing thousands. The tragedy underscored a cruel truth about climate change. It will hit the world's poorest the hardest. Dwelling in rickety houses in hot equatorial climates, the poor often are massed in low-lying flood zones or on the edge of deserts. Hurricanes and floods will wash communities away. Drought will crush farms and increase hunger. Meanwhile, these poorer nations often contribute the least to global warming, said Patty Poblet in sfgate.com. The Philippines emits 0.9 metric tons of carbon per capita, compared with America's 17.6 tons, yet it still bears the brunt of the burden. The typhoon has sparked the usual round of climate alarmist hysterics, said Greg Conterio in westernfreepress.com. But the frequency or intensity of typhoons has nothing to do with climate change. Cyclone experts say that both typhoons and hurricanes are influenced by the difference in the temperature of sea level air and tropospheric air, not the temperature of the water itself. So a rise in average global temperature would have no effect. And let's not forget the elephant in the room. Since 1998, there's been no discernible warming, and sea level rise has also stopped. Climate change alarmists love to play the blame game, but the evidence just isn't there. Actually, the evidence is there in dollars and cents, said Lindsay Abrams in Salon.com. Even if you want to ignore mountains of evidence that climate change is real, global losses from extreme weather have quadrupled from the 1980s to $200 billion a year, according to a new World Bank report. Americans are seeing the proof of this devastation firsthand, said Jeffrey Sachs in the Washington Post. Recent years have brought raging wildfires that have devastated the West, prolonged droughts that have wilted the Southwest, and fierce storms that have inundated the East Coast. Yet the U.S. is one of several developed nations resisting strict emissions limits or payments to third world nations. But in coming years, another spate of catastrophes could provide the tipping point. The next big political movement may be an environmental revolt. And a few notes here. A record 67.5 million women in the U.S. are currently employed, which means women have recovered all the jobs they lost during the 2008 recession, the U.S. Labor Department reported. About 69 million men hold jobs, which is still down 2 million from 2007. The difference? Male-dominated professions like construction and manufacturing have not fully recovered. Next week, Thanksgiving will fall on the first day of Hanukkah. Physicists calculate that the next Thanksgivica will not occur until A.D. 79,811. Leaks about National Security Agency's aggressive surveillance practices have sparked an 888% increase in open records requests by Americans demanding to know whether their phone calls and internet activity have been spied on. The NSA responds with a letter saying it can neither confirm nor deny that any information has been gathered. Between 2003 and 2011, the U.S. Army lost track of $5.8 billion worth of supplies. The Pentagon is the only federal agency that still does not produce complete audits of its spending and assets. 56% of Americans say it's not the government's responsibility to ensure that people have health care. In 2006, only 28% expressed that view, while 69% said it was the government's responsibility. And here's a quote from P.G. Wodehouse. The less you want a fellow, the more punctual he's bound to be. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.